Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're doing a really granular look at a fascinating career. It's, I think, a perfect case study in, well, resilience, adaptation, and really taking creative control in entertainment. We're talking about the journey of Canadian-American comedian, writer, director Bonnie McFarlane. She's a true multi-hyphenate, isn't she?
Oh, absolutely. And today, we're not just, listing things she's done. Our mission here is really to track her evolution. We're using the biographical facts, the milestones we've gathered, but we really want to zero in on those pivot points.
Strategic leaps, right?
Exactly. Those leaps, like from winning a regional comedy contest up in Canada to getting onto basically every major late-night stage in the U.S., and crucially, how she seems to have turned professional disappointment, we'll get into that, to fuel for writing, directing, even publishing a memoir.
Okay.
So for you listening, the goal is to really extract the definitive knowledge. How does a comedian actually maintain relevance, like sustained relevance, over decades?
Right. Okay, let's unpack this. Let's unpack this whole trajectory. And we're starting, well, pretty far from the bright lights of late night TV, actually. We need to set the scene, I think, for a career that seems built entirely on self-determination.
Okay, so let's start with the roots. Geographical, familial, because they give that necessary contrast to where she ended up. The sources confirm Bonnie McFarlane, born March 28, 1969, so 56 this year, in Cold Lake, Alberta, Canada. And that's important, isn't it? Cold Lake.
It really is because, her comedic voice, it's often very observational, kind of dry, grounded. And you can trace that grounding, I think, right back to her upbringing, raised on her parents' rural farm, like outside of Cold Lake.
Right.
We're talking genuine rural life here, maybe even isolation. And that kind of lifestyle, it breeds self-sufficiency, right? And a very specific worldview, often skeptical, which is gold for comedy.
Yeah, you can see that. And the family dynamic too.
Yeah.
Youngest of four daughters being the youngest of four girls, especially maybe in a rural setting.
Yeah.
That suggests maybe having to fight for attention, a built-in audience maybe. Could be. Test material, maybe develop that sharp observational eye just from, constant sibling interaction. So you take that combination, that sort of rural Alberta setting, plus that immediate, maybe competitive little world of four daughters, and it gives you a framework for her material, potentially. But, the distance from actual entertainment hubs meant that the jump to professional stand-up, it had to be deliberate and probably had to work kind of quickly.
Okay, so how does she make that leap? From a farm outside Cold Lake to, a stage, the sources point to the very first step. Her first open mic happened in Vancouver, British Columbia,
Right. Vancouver.
which is a massive distance from Alberta, geographically and culturally, maybe. It suggests a really clear initial move just for comedy.
And what's fascinating, apparently, is the immediate validation she got. Like right away, she gets on stage in Vancouver, and a club manager, someone whose job is spotting talent, right, doesn't just say, "Hey, good set." No. The manager gives her this really specific, kind of high stakes instruction: enter this contest. It was called The Search for Canada's Funniest New Comic.
Wow. Okay. So the manager saw something legit fast.
Yeah. And it's interesting because maybe that manager realized, look, to even think about the U.S. market later, she needs a credential, like a professional calling card from Canada.
Makes sense. And she took the advice.
She did enter the contest and won it.
Okay, so she wins Canada's Funniest New Comic.
Yeah. And that win becomes the definitive launchpad. For a Canadian comic looking south, I mean, this wasn't just like bragging rights. It was the push she needed for the next big career move.
Like a passport, you said?
Kind of a professional passport. It gave her the confidence, sure, but also that demonstrable proof of marketability, the kind you need to get attention from, agents and managers in the States.
And the sources show that transition was quick, right? After the win, she moves directly to New York.
Yep, New York City.
And it wasn't a slow build. It says she landed both a manager and an agent pretty much on arrival.
Hang on, though. Landing major representation immediately after coming from like the regional Canadian circuit?
Yeah.
That sounds really unusual.
It is unusual, highly unusual. The source material doesn't give us like a specific anecdote about how exactly, but the fact she got both right away, it speaks volumes about how good that contest winning set must have been.
Right.
Must
Must
have.
have killed.
Yeah. I mean, managers and agents in New York, they're looking for talent that can work the U.S. circuit basically now. And having that Canadian title meant she was kind of pre-vetted, you know.
Okay.
And she wasn't just content with New York either. She kept up this crucial bi-coastal strategy, spent time in Los Angeles too, focusing on stand-up but also writing.
Right, the L.A. writing connection.
Yeah.
Still, maintaining a presence on both coasts, especially back then, late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
That sounds incredibly tough.
Whoa.
Financially, logistically.
Oh, grueling. Double the travel, double the instability, probably finding places to crash.
So why? Strategically, why was that so important? Well, the goals were different on each coast, right? New York really cements your stand-up club credibility, gets you those vital late-night bookings. But Los Angeles, that's the engine for writing rooms, for development deals, maybe eventually getting into film or sitcoms.
Gotcha. Covering all the bases.
Exactly. By hitting both markets at the same time, she positioned herself not just as a performer, but as a potential writer. A creator,
yeah.
Right from the start. And that early strategic diversification, I think that's absolutely key to her longevity. We see that play out later, hashtag tag three, the stand-up grind and late-night visibility.
Okay, so she, in the U.S., she's got representation. She's working both coasts. Now, the next big hurdle, especially before social media really took over, it was late-night TV, right? Getting a stand-up spot on one of the big shows, that meant instant national recognition and a huge boost to your, like, headlining fee at clubs.
Oh, totally. And we see her establishing that credibility pretty quickly. Mm. She achieved what you might call the late night trifecta. Mm. She appeared on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, mm. Late Show with David Letterman, and The Late Late Show with Craig Kilborn.
Okay, so Leno, Letterman, Kilborn, that's huge. For a comedian, especially then, that's like getting three Michelin stars or something.
Pretty much. These weren't just, you know, 5 minutes on stage. They were stamps of approval. From the biggest gatekeepers in American TV at the time, it solidified her status way beyond just the club circuit.
Yeah, it's more than just currency. It's like an established brand identity almost. Those sets proved she had material that worked for a mass audience, a mainstream audience. And that opens doors, right, to pivot into different TV formats, which you need for sustainability.
Absolutely essential. And we see her doing that, moving beyond just the pure stand-up sets into the world of panel shows, guest roles, which demand different skills entirely.
Like what?
Well, she was a panelist on two really distinct, often debate-heavy shows.
Mm.
Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Intense.
Right. And Red Eye W. Greg Gutfeld.
Also intense, but different. More political, maybe.
Yeah, different flavors of intensity. Tough Crowd really required comics to think super fast, argue points, sometimes get genuinely kind of aggressive with their wit.
Mm-hmm.
Red Eye involved more like synthesizing current events, delivering commentary, often with a political slant.
Mm.
So appearing on both shows, she was transitioning from just telling jokes to having like a recognizable, marketable perspective on things.
Which is a different skill set entirely.
It really is. It shows she could integrate her viewpoint into almost a journalistic or quasi-political setting.
Yeah.
And there's another detail here that I think is really cool. It ties her into the sort of foundational comedy ecosystem of that era.
What's that?
She appeared as one of Dr. Katz's patients on the animated show, Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist.
Oh, wow. Dr. Katz, that's a deep cut for comedy nerds. That show was legendary.
Totally legendary. Often improvised with, like, the absolute top club comedians of the day. Jonathan Katz talking to Don Marrera, Ray Romano, Laura Keitlinger. So being featured there, even as a voice, meant she was already operating in the highest tiers of that New York stand-up community, mm-hmm. recognized by her peers as, you know, a legitimate voice.
Okay, so she's got late night, she's got panel shows, she's got the respect of her peers. What about specials, the sort of pinnacle for a stand-up?
Right. Beyond just guest spots, the ultimate validation is getting your own televised special. Shows you could hold an audience, deliver a whole cohesive hour or half hour. And she hit two major milestones there. First, in 2005, she got her own HBO one-night stand special.
HBO, that was and still is pretty prestigious.
The prestige slot, yeah. Often seen as career-defining. Then, just 3 years later, in 2008, she landed her own Comedy Central Presents half-hour special.
Okay, Comedy Central, different vibe, maybe wider reach to the core comedy fans.
Exactly. Two different beasts. HBO signals that industry quality standard. Comedy Central gives you that broader, maybe younger, more targeted exposure right to the comedy audience. So hitting both networks kind of proves she was successfully bridging that gap between prestige and mass market appeal.
So by 2008, you look at her career on paper, it looks kind of bulletproof, right? Canadian success, top representation, late night trifecta, key panel roles, two major network specials.
Seems like a straight lineup. But success is rarely that simple, is it?
Usually not.
Which brings us to a really, really important pivot point. Or maybe a bump in the road, depending how you look at it. Hashtag tag Ive, reality TV hosting, and the pivot points.
Okay, this is where we get into something different. Competitive reality TV, specifically season 2 of the NBC show Last Comic Standing. This was in 2004.
Right, 2004.
Now, for a comedian who'd already done Letterman, done HBO, entering a competition like Last Comic Standing, which was super visible, high stakes, that feels like a big move, like a declaration of intent or something.
It does. But the sources reveal this major unexpected twist. Despite all that prior success, all that established credibility, she was the first comedian eliminated from the competition in season 2.
Wait, the first one out?
The very first one eliminated.
Did you wait her? She'd done Leno? She'd done Letterman? How does that happen? If you're already headlining clubs and doing top-tier late night, why are you the first one voted off a reality competition?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it's critical for analysis, I think. It probably speaks less about her actual talent.
Right.
And more about the very specific, sometimes kind of brutal nature of reality TV competition humor. It's often different from established club humor.
How so?
Well, first, the competition itself was fierce. You have to contextualize Last Comic Standing. Just look at some names associated with the show over its run. Amy Schumer, Kathleen Madigan, Ralphie May, Rich Voss.
Right, her future husband. We'll get to that.
Yeah. So it was packed with serious talent, future stars. But the format of LCS, it often prioritized stuff that was, like, easily digestible, high energy, designed for quick TV sound bites.
Okay.
And sometimes that format could penalize humor that's maybe drier, more observational, more subtle, the kind of stuff that kills in a dedicated club setting over an hour. So it's possible her style, maybe more nuanced, just didn't deliver the kind of immediate competitive punch the show's structure needed. Yeah. Or maybe the judges or voters just didn't fully grasp the depth of her existing reputation.
That's tough. Being the first one eliminated, especially that publicly, I mean, that could have been totally ego-crushing. Could have ended things for some people.
Absolutely. But her next moves, they suggest she didn't see it as a defeat. Maybe more like a redirection.
Mm-hmm.
She seemed to use that very public stumble as a strategic inflection point.
How so? What does she do next?
Well, maybe it taught her a lesson. Like, relying solely on stage performance and those traditional Gatekeepers Network TV competition producers, bookers, maybe that wasn't the only way. Or maybe not sustainable long term. Because she seemed to pivot pretty quickly towards roles that emphasized her personality, her facilitating skills. Hosting roles.
Oh, okay. Hosting, that makes sense. Less pressure to win a set, more about being a stable presence.
Exactly. And we see her shift into media targeting specific demographics, which shows versatility too. She was one of the hosts for that Nickelodeon program, Nick Mom Night Out.
Right, Nick Mom. That launched around what, 2012?
Around then, yeah. August 2012.
Yeah.
And she also hosted something called Comedy.TV.
Okay, so these roles, they require a different muscle, like you said. Not the pressure of landing every single joke perfectly in a 5-minute set, but the stability of being, you know, a welcoming, quick-witted host who can guide a show.
And it probably provided some necessary financial and visibility stability after that LCS bump.
But the real shift, maybe towards more control, seems to come through audio, doesn't it? Radio, then podcasting.
Yes. This laid the groundwork, I think, for the platform she has now, which is really enduring. She started making occasional appearances on the very popular Opie and Anthony radio program back in the day.
Right, O&A. Huge loyal audience.
Huge. And she later continued appearing when it became the Opie and Jim Norton show.
Why was that exposure so important, do you think?
Well, Opie and Anthony, they cultivated this large, very loyal, often pretty demanding comedy fan base. They valued raw, long-form conversation, behind-the-scenes honesty.
Mm-hmm. Less polished.
Much less polished. And that environment, it was kind of the perfect training ground for developing that intimate, unfiltered persona that works so well in modern podcasting. The audience she built there, they were probably directly transferable to her own independent work later.
Which brings us neatly to her most significant and probably most enduring media project currently, the podcast My Wife Hates Me, which she co-hosts, of course, with her husband, Rich Voss.
Yes. And this move, this is the ultimate act of creative autonomy, isn't it? Bypassing networks, bypassing gatekeepers entirely. It's like the ultimate evolution of the comedic persona. They took their actual lives, their personal relationship, which, you know, the public already had some interest in because they were both comics, and they monetized the dynamic itself.
It's kind of genius, really, turning the everyday stuff of marriage, especially a marriage between two comedians, into content.
Right. Direct, uncensored relationship with their audience. It's really a modern model of comedy entrepreneurship, building your own platform.
So that podcast represents one kind of creative control, but there's another major pivot point we need to discuss, especially after experiencing the, let's say, limitations of being just a performer in someone else's system, like the Last Comic Standing format. Mm-hmm. She took even fuller creative control, right, by moving into filmmaking, actually writing and directing.
Yes, that's a huge structural shift in a career. She decides to basically critique the very industry she spent years navigating. By writing and directing the film, Women Aren't Funny.
Women Aren't Funny. Okay, so the title itself is provocative.
Extremely provocative.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just like a standard movie. It was more of a documentary or maybe a docu-comedy hybrid. And it directly questions that old pervasive industry assumption or maybe just tired joke that women are inherently less funny than men.
Wow. So that's a really powerful move. It transforms her from being like a subject within the industry to becoming an authorial voice commenting on the industry.
Precisely. And we have a timeline for it. The film was previewed at Caroline's on Broadway, a major comedy club, in November 2012. Then it was officially released in August 2014. So that, you know, almost two-year gap suggests a real commitment. Seeing a big independent project all the way through.
Yeah, making an indie film is a marathon.
For sure. And creating that film, which tackles gender politics and comedy head-on, feels like a necessary response, maybe, to the kind of turbulence she'd experienced, including that LCS elimination. It's basically her saying, okay, you tried to define me or dismiss me based on these weird industry rules. Now I get to define the terms of the debate.
That's a strong statement. And then she moved into yet another medium, the literary world. She released her memoir, You're Better Than Me, in 2016.
Right. The memoir, which is often a comedian's way of like providing the footnotes to their act, isn't it? Giving context to the pain, the jokes, the journey.
Totally. But there's a detail about the publication here that's really interesting. And surprising.
Yeah, this is genuinely surprising and I think offers this profound external validation for the book. The memoir was published by Anthony Bourdain.
Anthony Bourdain, the chef, the writer, the traveler.
At Anthony Bourdain. He had his own publishing imprint. And that connection is really significant. Bourdain's editorial brand, it was all about candor, brutal honesty, the outsider perspective, often focusing on people who came up through tough, maybe unglamorous, uncompromising systems. Like kitchens or maybe comedy clubs.
So getting published under the Bourdain imprint, it immediately signals something, doesn't it? That this isn't just like a standard celebrity tell-all.
Exactly. It signals it's likely a serious work of nonfiction, probably pretty raw, connecting her personal story to maybe a broader cultural commentary.
And the content reinforces that.
It does. The book explicitly recounts her upbringing, that crucial rural farm life we talked about, and of course her comedic career. And make sure the reader understands that the voice they hear on stage or on the podcast, that self-reliant, often critical voice, it's rooted directly in those early, maybe isolated experiences back in Alberta.
So she's basically capitalizing on the full circle narrative.
Yeah.
Turning every bit of her life right down to the farm into, well, commercial art.
It's effectively, yeah. It connects all those threads we've discussed, the geographic isolation, maybe sibling rivalry, the drive to leave, the struggles, the successes, and frames it all as kind of necessary prep work for who she became. She transformed the biographical facts into a real literary asset.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground. Stand-up, TV, film, writing. But we have to circle back to something central now. That personal and professional collaboration that really defines her current media footprint. Her partnership with Rich Voss.
Absolutely fundamental. As we know, Farling married fellow comedian Rich Voss in 2005. They have one child together, which, you know, grounds that professional collaboration in a very real shared life. But their relationship itself immediately became the content.
Through the podcast, My Wife Hates Me, which is, by all accounts, very successful.
Hugely successful. It's a masterful crossover, really, taking the dynamic, the tensions, the everyday annoyances of a long marriage, especially between two comics with strong personalities, and making that the core reliable output.
It's daily relatable stuff, right? And it requires minimal external production. It just relies on their chemistry, or maybe their anti-chemistry sometimes.
Exactly. Their dynamic is the show. And just to layer it in again, if we look back at that competitive context, we should remember Rich Voss was also a contestant on Last Comic Standing.
Right. Different season, I think.
Different seasons, yeah. But that shared experience, navigating that specific, intense, televised competition, even with different outcomes,
yeah,
it must add another layer of I don't know, shared professional understanding or maybe shared trauma to their relationship dynamic.
They both know that specific kind of pressure cooker.
Yeah.
And maybe what failure in that context feels like.
Yeah. They both get it. So when we try to synthesize this whole journey now, what does it tell us about her professional identity? We've seen her identified as a Canadian stand-up, a Canadian woman comedian, a Last Comic Standing contestant, a successful Canadian expat in the U.S., and now, you know, a resident of New Jersey who's built this sustainable collaborative media thing.
There's a lot of labels.
It is. But if you connect those diverse roles, her longevity, it doesn't seem accidental at all. It looks like a masterclass in strategic adaptation and, crucially, self-authorship. Meaning, she understood, maybe early on or maybe after that LCS experience, that relying only on the traditional stand-up path clubs, late-night bookers, network competitions was precarious, unstable. The real key to her durability seems to be that pivot from being primarily a performer of material to becoming a creator of platforms and intellectual property.
So she didn't just like survive the volatility of the business.
No, she leveraged her experiences, even the rejections like LCS. She used them to develop IP, the film, the memoir, the podcast platform. And that allowed her to control her own narrative and, crucially, create multiple independent revenue streams.
It was the holy grail for creatives, right?
Pretty much. Yeah. The fact that she was the first one eliminated from a major network competition, in the grand scheme of her career now, it's just a chapter. An interesting anecdote, not the defining moment.
Right. Because the true story is what happened after.
Exactly. She immediately went on to do that HBO special and ultimately wrote and directed a film that offered a structural critique of the very industry that, you know, contained that competition in the first place. She literally turned institutional failure or perceived failure into creative fuel.
She used her own experience as the material, building a career based on authenticity, yes, but also incredible resilience. And that ability, that constant adaptation to media shifts, demanding self-control over her work, that seems like the biggest lesson anyone trying to make it in a creative field can take from this deep dive. Hashtag tag Stadi Witten. Outro. So let's quickly recap this this pretty remarkable evolution for you listening. Bonnie McFarlane's foundation, it started way back on that rural farm, Cold Lake, Alberta, gave her a specific, maybe skeptical, observational lens. That perspective gets validated early by winning that key comedy contest in Vancouver, which acted like a professional passport, right? Got her into the U.S. late night scene, achieved that ubiquity.
Yeah, and then we saw those critical pivot points, especially that very public rejection, being the first contestant eliminated on Last Comic Standing Season 2. But that perceived failure, it seemed to immediately fuel her strategic shift, becoming a creator. Writing and directing the film Women Aren't Funny, which really critiqued the industry. Authoring her candid memoir, You're Better Than Me, which got that amazing Anthony Bourdain validation.
Right. And finally, she successfully leveraged her actual life, her personal partnership with WitchVoss, into a sustainable, very personalized media platform, that popular podcast, My Wife Hates Me, proving the value of, you know, collaboration and just consistent output, maybe over-relying on traditional gatekeepers.
Which really raises an important question, I think, for you, the listener. As you look at the media landscape today, which is always shifting, given McFarlane's success across so many different roles, stand-up, panelist, director, author, podcaster, what actually is the single most valuable platform for a comedian right now?
Good question.
Is it still the stage, you know, where you get immediate feedback, tighten the material, earn money night to night? Is it the screen, TV, or film that gives you maximum reach? Or is it the really personalized medium, like the podcast, that builds that direct, super committed audience that will follow you anywhere, buy your merch, come to your shows?
Her career arc seems to suggest maybe the answer isn't any one of those things.
Maybe not. Maybe the answer is the constant necessity of self-authorship that we talked about. That ability she demonstrated to shift her identity from being just a comedian who performs material to being a creative professional who creates her own platforms, owns her own intellectual property. That seems to be what ensured her remarkable longevity and allowed her ultimately to define success completely on her own terms.
And that right there, that adaptability and control, is probably the key knowledge we hope you walk away with today.